Right now, Israel is at war with Iran. But even before that war broke out, Iran plays a major role in world events. News broadcasts, they're always talking about Iran. Why are they so significant? And what does Bible prophecy have to say about them? Let's find out on today's Trumpet World. Matthew 24 and verse 3 details the disciples of Jesus Christ coming and saying, "Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world?" Christ's disciples came to Jesus Christ and talked to him about Bible prophecy and about his return to the earth. And Jesus Christ's response isn't to say, "Well, don't really get into that. That's a bit strange. That's a bit weird." He starts talking about Bible prophecy. He starts taking them through signs and warnings and specific events. In verse 15, for example, he starts talking about the book of Daniel. So he makes clear, well, you need to understand Bible prophecy from the Old Testament as well. In Acts 1 and verse 11, after Jesus Christ ascended into heaven, the disciples are told that he will return. And you put these passages together, you see he wants Christians to understand end time events and Bible prophecy. And so today I want to look at what Bible prophecy says about Iran. They obviously play a huge role in world events, but they also play a major role in Bible prophecy. So with that introduction, let's look at Daniel 11 and verse 40, a scripture that shows us the role that Iran plays in Bible prophecy. And this begins by saying, at the time of the end, there is prophecy for this end time. Daniel chapter 12 and verse 1 gives us more information about this at the time of the end. And it says that, well, at the time of the end shall Michael stand up, the great prince which stands for the children of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. Jesus Christ talked about this same time in Matthew chapter 24. And he said that it would get so bad that if he didn't return, no flesh would be saved alive. Mankind would destroy himself. So here, there would be a king of the south at the time of the end, at a time when mankind has weapons of mass destruction. And it's telling us about how a conflict gets kicked off that involves weapons of mass destruction, nuclear bombs. Even this is kind of mind-blowing. The idea that a human being 2,000 years ago could imagine mankind having weapons so destructive that he could wipe himself out. I mean, the most destructive weapon when Jesus Christ was speaking in Matthew 24 was probably something like a catapult, which barely compares to a nuclear bomb. These are prophecies coming from the mind of God, and it tells us that there's going to be this king of the south at this end time. So Daniel chapter 11 gives us a long vision. It's one of the longest prophecies in the Bible. It begins by talking about events that would happen in the years and centuries after Daniel lives. Daniel 11 verse 2, verse 3 starts to talk about Alexander the Great being defeated, his kingdom splitting four different ways. It then describes what would happen to the successor kingdoms of Alexander, particularly the ones that dominated the Middle East. And it describes these not in some kind of vague Nostradamus fashion, but in a way that's so crystal clear that scholars insist, well, the book of Daniel had to be written after Alexander the Great and after all of these different kings. Because if they admit that Daniel was written before, and there's masses of evidence that Daniel was written before, if they acknowledge that, they have to admit there's a living God, and they have to admit that that living God prophesies the future and forecasts world events and wants us to understand these. But the real focus of the book of Daniel and this prophecy in Daniel chapter 11 is for the time of the end. And even many of these ancient events that it describes so specifically, so accurately, are types of what will happen in the end time. And Daniel 11 talks about this clash. At the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. So in all these previous discussions, it's been talking about a king of the north and a king of the south. And in those previous verses, the king of the north is the Seleucid kingdom, largely based in Syria, set up by one of Alexander's generals that rules a lot of the Middle East. And then the king of the south is Ptolemaic Egypt. Again, one of these Alexander's generals setting up a dynasty and ruling Egypt, and it describes all of those clashes. But then we jump forward in time in Daniel 11 and verse 40, talking about the time of the end. So who is this king of the north and who is this king of the south now? While some of the history gives us a clue, the Roman general Pompey the Great conquered the kingdom of Syria in 65 BC, conquered the Seleucids, and from here on, the Roman Empire is talked about as the king of the north. And the Roman Empire is resurrected in the Holy Roman Empire, and it's a European king of the north. But also, we can look at other Bible prophecies, and we can see that these are other Bible prophecies that are talking very clearly about a European power. You know, the king of the north prophecy in Daniel 11 matches very closely with what the book of Revelation says about the beast power. And you can see very clearly this beast power, it's led by a woman, a church in Bible prophecy. It's resurrected many times. Where is there an empire that rises and falls and is led by a church? This is referring to a European power. It all fits perfectly together. This isn't coming from the minds of many different authors writing hundreds of years apart. I mean, you wouldn't fit perfectly together if this were just different human minds giving their ideas about the future. It's coming from the mind of God. But who is the king of the south? This is for at the time of the end. This is for the time when there are weapons of mass destruction. We should know. There should be someone that God has revealed this to and has opened their mind to this understanding. And for many years, Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry has said the king of the south refers to Iran. This is from a 1993 Key of David where he talked about this.
So the king of the south must arise after Daniel was revealed. These verses point to a king of the south that is yet future. And I believe all indications point to radical Islam headed by Iran as this king. The king of the north is guided by a great religion, and it appears the king of the south is also. That is probably the only way they can unite anyhow. That is religion bringing them together.
So radical Islam led by Iran, leading this king of the south. And we'll talk about the role that religion plays here in just a moment. But he talks about this king of the south controlling Iran, controlling the Iraq area. And really, we've seen Iran take control of both Iran and Iraq. Here's a second clip from that Key of David.
Crucial prophecies are being fulfilled right now. Very crucial prophecies, and the kind of prophecies that are going to affect your personal life, no matter where you live on this earth. The king of the south could rule Iraq or Iran or both countries, but it is looking more now like Iran may produce this king. It looks very much like the end-time king of the south will rule the radical Islamists. Iran is a natural leader for many of them today. You can see that just by reading your newspapers.
So Iran looks like this king of the south. So why would Mr. Flurry say that? Why talk about Iran as this king of the south? Well, let's look at what the Bible says and think about, well, who could this king of the south be? Or this power to the south of the king of the north. Well, Egypt might be an obvious candidate to think about, well, who's a big dominant power within the Middle East and even in Africa. But if we read verse 41, it says, "He, the king of the north, shall enter into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But even these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. And he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape." So Egypt is mentioned as separate to the king of the south. Egypt can't be the king of the south. If we keep going, it says, "But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his step." So the Libyans and the Ethiopians, they can't be the king of the south either. Well, who else is a major Middle Eastern power? Well, perhaps Turkey could be a candidate for leading radical Islam or leading Islam and being the king of the south. But they get a whole other book of the Bible about them, Obadiah. And that's quite a different role that they play to the king of the south. Saudi Arabia is a separate power? Could they be the king of the south? Well, again, there are separate prophecies that we actually did an earlier video on the Psalm 83 Alliance, and we can put a link to that in the show notes. They're talked about separately, and that's made very clear, actually, that the Arabians are allied with the king of the north. They're mentioned separately, and you can go and look at that separate video. So that leaves Iran as pretty much the only option. A lot of the other options are eliminated. And let's look at Iran. How do they fulfill this role? Well, who really is pushing, has this pushy foreign policy? Well, Iran. And this is why they're engaged in a war right now. They're constantly carrying out attacks, getting nuclear weapons. They've kidnapped, basically, British, American soldiers, working with terrorist groups around the world. You can also see evidence for Iran being the king of the south when you see the central role that Jerusalem plays in this Daniel 11 prophecy. If we look in verse 45, again, talking about the king of the north, it says, "And he shall plant the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him." So the king of the north sets up his headquarters in Jerusalem. In verse 41, it talks about this king of the north entering into the glorious land. This conflict is a conflict that revolves around Israel, that revolves around the Holy Land. And that helps us then see again that the king of the north is this Holy Roman Empire, this rising power in Europe that will be led by a church. It's a religious power that puts a lot of focus on conquering Jerusalem, so much so that the religious leader moves his headquarters there. He considers Jerusalem to be an exceptionally holy place. It's the center of the universe, the center of his religion. In his book, Prophesy Again, Mr. Flurry wrote, "Why, after conquering the king of the south, would this power enter Jerusalem? There must be a lot going on in that city that he's concerned about. These two kings are warring over Jerusalem, and the king of the north wants to secure it for his religion." He quotes verse 45 about planting the palace of his tabernacle in the glorious holy mountain and says, "This great false church has a leader who will plant his throne in Jerusalem. You must have the greatest passion for Jerusalem to move your headquarters there." And he says, "I believe this too indicates that Jerusalem is where the push occurs." This is a conflict all around Jerusalem. It figures very heavily in Daniel 11. This clash revolves around Jerusalem. So the king of the north, this religious Christian Catholic power rising in Europe, has a strong focus on Jerusalem. Who else would clash over Jerusalem? Who else has a strong focus over Jerusalem? It's the Muslim world. Jerusalem is the third most sacred site for the Islamic world. They teach that Muhammad was kind of mystically transported to Al-Aqsa, or to Jerusalem, and then from Jerusalem to heaven, to the Father Mosque. And the Quran doesn't say that this event revolved around Jerusalem, but Muslim tradition teaches that it did, and Islam also absorbed a lot from the religions around it that it grew up around, including Christianity and Judaism. So it has a strong focus on Jerusalem. So the Islamic world in general has a strong focus on Jerusalem, and Iran in particular is obsessed with it. One of the main branches of their army, the branch that kind of runs the overseas military operation, is called the Quds Force. Al-Quds is the Arabic name for Jerusalem. They've labeled the overseas branch of their army, for Britain was the British Expeditionary Force. For Iran, it's the Jerusalem Force. And they hold Quds Day, Jerusalem Day, with all kinds of military parades. They're really focused on that. A lot of their propaganda talks about that. Just as an example, here's a video Iran put out about 10 years ago or so, where it really makes clear that the way they work with Hezbollah, the way they work with Hamas, Palestinian, all revolves around conquering Jerusalem. And it shows all of these different branches that Iran is working with, all uniting to go and conquer Jerusalem. You can play that now. So when you see the central role that Jerusalem plays in Daniel chapter 11, and then you see the central role in Iranian thinking that Jerusalem plays, it makes very clear that they're fulfilling this role of the king of the south. And another way that we can see Iran playing this role of the king of the south is when you look at the titanic role that Persia has played in history. I mean, Iran has been a major player for centuries, for millennia. You had Cyrus's Persian Empire, most famously, 500 BC, 400 BC, the Persians sending the Jews home to go and rebuild the temple. You had the Parthian Empire from about 250 BC to around 200 AD. They were facing off against the Roman Empire for over 400 years, and Rome couldn't really conquer them. They were one of the few powers that could go toe-to-toe with the Roman Empire. After the Parthian Empire fell, they were very quickly taken over by the Sasanian Empire. Again, another Persian Empire in the same kind of territory, slightly different group ruling it. They were from 224 to about 650 AD. So Persia repeatedly is a major power. Persia itself is a strong heartland. Iran, very hard to invade on the ground with mountains. They can then come down into Iraq relatively easily. If they can take that, they gain good agricultural land, good trade routes. They could become wealthy and a major force. The Sasanian Empire was taken over by the Muslim world, but they soon became a very major part of that Muslim world. And you had the whole of the kind of the Muslim Empire or the Middle East being ruled from Baghdad in Iraq, but with close ties to Persia. And they have their ups and downs. A lot of downs after Columbus and after ocean-going trade starts going in large ships instead of caravans through the Middle East. And they cease kind of becoming this crossroads of the world. They're much less wealthy. But they are still, to use a bit of a cliche, an ancient and proud people. They've got a long, long heritage. And they're distinct from the Arabs. They're different people. That leads to friction between the two. And the Arabs accuse the Persians of looking down on them. And maybe there's some truth. There's some truth to that. They are a different people. And around 1500 AD, Iran emphasizes this by adopting a different strain of religion, adopting Shia Islam as opposed to Sunni Islam, which is the norm for a lot of the Middle East. And Iran today is really the center for Shia Islam, though there are other very significant Shia groups all around the world as well. And even this Shia Islam ties in perfectly to Iran's role as king of the south. Shia Islam looks at least the main branch of Shia Islam. There's, of course, all kinds of different subdivisions. It looks at who should be the ruler and leader of the Muslim world as kind of being tied to the bloodline of Muhammad. I mean, even the name Shia, it comes from Shi'at Ali, or the party of Ali, an individual that they thought should succeed Muhammad as leader of the Muslim world. And they see kind of it coming through the bloodline of Ali. It has to be somebody who is related to Ali, who is related to Muhammad. And so the Shia Muslims follow this line of imams, these successors, and it keeps going until you get to the 11th imam, who's murdered by Sunnis, and he dies without having any children, which is a bit of a problem if you believe that the only rightful ruler has this bloodline. What happens at this point then is they claim that this 11th imam secretly has a kid. Now, they could have, I guess, produced any old kid and said, well, this is the guy. But it's a bit more subtle than that. That something could go wrong, a fraud could be exposed, the kid could be killed. So instead, they say that he had a son, but he's in occlusion. And there's not a lot of great definitions onto what occlusion means, but it's kind of like King Arthur. Supposedly, he's somehow still around, hidden, dormant, in fairyland, that kind of thing. And so there's this imam in occlusion, and he's been in occlusion since 874 AD. He's spent more than 1,100 years kind of in hiding. And the main branch of Shia Islam in Iran believes that he's going to return at the end of the world. And it's quite clearly a counterfeit of Jesus Christ's return. And the 11th imam was assassinated. This guy is the 12th imam. and those that believe in him and that he's in occlusion and will someday return are known as Twelvers. And about 85% of Shiites are Twelvers. And this 12th Imam is also given the title El Mahdi or the Mahdi. There's other branches of Islam that have also Mahdiist beliefs, that they believe that there's a guy, a Mahdi, that's going to kind of come on the scene in the end times. They don't kind of give him the same backstory of being the 12th Imam, but they have this same figure. And this gives Iran a really strong focus on war and war with the rest, war with the West. Ayatollah Khomeini, Iran's supreme leader, he said, "We must prepare for the coming. Since we consider ourselves warriors of the 12th Imam, we must fight. The issue of Imam Mahdi is of utmost importance, and his reappearance has been clearly stated in our holy religion of Islam," he said. "We must study and remind ourselves of the end times and Imam Mahdi's era." And then he said, "We must prepare the environment for the coming so that the great leader will come." And this is part of the reason why Iran is so pushy. They believe general chaos, war between Islam and the rest of the world. These are the conditions that you need for this Imam to come. And so they're working on creating these conditions. And that's part of why there's a strong focus on a clash over Jerusalem. It's all about creating the conditions for the return of their Mahdi. And so that's part of the reason why Iran uses a lot of terrorism. If we look at some more modern history, we see the way Iran really leads a lot of Middle Eastern terrorism. They're a key root of modern terrorism. And if we look at a bit more recent history of Iran, to go back to that cliche of being a proud and ancient people, you know, they did genuinely contribute masses to world history. And then in the 19th century, they're militarily and technologically weak and kind of backwards, and they're getting pushed around by everyone. They're getting pushed around by Russia, pushed around by Britain. 1907, Britain and Russia basically kind of divide Iran in effect between the two of them, or Persia as it is called then. World War I, they're occupied by the British, the Russians, the Ottomans. 20s and 30s, they basically side with Hitler. They're not an outright Axis power, but they're very clearly leaning in that direction. A German-allied Iran at the heart of the Middle East with all of those fuel supplies during World War II would be absolutely catastrophic. So Britain and Russia overthrow the government and take Iran over during World War II. Iran is then drawn into the Cold War. There's lots of upheavals. There's lots of coups and attempted coups. The UK and the USA launch a coup. They force out Mohammad Mossadegh, the prime minister, out of office. Basically, he was trying to nationalize British oil. And then Iran kind of becomes one of those countries during the Cold War, like South Korea, like Taiwan. Like, well, maybe they're a dictatorship, but they're our dictatorship. Kind of a setup. And they're not really a great regime. They have the SAVAK, the secret police. I think there were estimated to be about 100 political prisoners killed during the 1970s. But Britain, America, we kind of back them because Iran is a very strategic, very important location, and we don't want to risk them going to the Soviets. And maybe in time, Iran would have followed a similar path to South Korea or Taiwan, to transition from a kind of Western-aligned dictatorship to a more Western-aligned democracy. Given the role of Islam in the Middle East, that's a strong dynamic that wasn't there in say, South Korea or Taiwan. So maybe that wouldn't have happened. But regardless, 1978, you start to get mass demonstrations against the Shah of Iran, leading to the 1979 revolution at the start of that year. And this is huge for the Middle East. A massive moment. Because it's the big scale arrival of political Islam. When you think about the Cold War, the Cold War is between the atheist Soviet Union and the United States of America, that is, you know, nominally Christian. Maybe nominally is too harsh for during the Cold War. There's a lot of people that genuinely take their Christianity seriously, but it's very much kind of a Sunday, you go to church on Sunday religion, and it doesn't have a massive impact on the rest of the week or on foreign policy. I mean, maybe you did have some leaders talk in terms of the fight with Russia or the Cold War in terms of a crusade, but that wasn't a literal religious war. And it was more about belief in things like freedom and democracy than it was Christianity and spreading that around the world. And so religion is, you know, very much viewed as in the past. You know, we kind of had the wars of religion 200 or 300 years ago. But now we're generally atheist and secular, and it doesn't play that big of a role in world events. And then you have Iran, and you have the Iranian revolution. And like with a lot of revolutions, you have a lot of people that want to get rid of the Shah that don't necessarily agree on what follows. And you've got all kinds of different, you've got a pretty broad spectrum. You've got people that wanted a secular Iran. You've got a lot of communists because Russia is working quite hard to swing Iran into their orbit. And you have things like the People's Mujahideen that kind of blend communism and Islam together. But you've also got the kind of the radical Ayatollah Khomeini and his faction that are some of the most prepared and the most ruthless. And once the Shah is pushed out, they very quickly take over and set up Iran as a theocracy, as an Islamist republic, it's called, but really all the power rests with the supreme leader. And so now religion is back, Islam is back. And they very quickly work to export the revolution. So they become the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism. They set up the Quds Force, the Jerusalem Force, as a branch of the military to spread this to other countries. And so since 1979, Iran has reached out across the Middle East to try and export this revolution, helping, working with other terrorist groups or terrorist groups all across the world. So this background, their leadership of political Islam, the exporting of terrorists, terrorism, and this is all part of their role as king of the South. Now, they are a Shia power. They'll still work with Sunni groups if it meets their aim of bringing down Israel in the Middle East with a strong focus on Jerusalem, but also bringing down the United States that they see as kind of upholding this secular global economic system, political system. They want to bring down the United States too. And we've seen them be successful in this and also be pushed back. They've successfully exported a lot of their power to Iraq, and they dominate that. They brought in Syria and Lebanon into their orbit, and they have been busted out of Iran's orbit now. And Daniel 11 does indicate this change in direction and shows us that Iran is going to shift their focus. If we look in verse 42 again, he shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, and he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and Ethiopians shall be at his steps. So here the king of the north, they take over the king of the south and Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia. So that tells us Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia are not the king of the south, but they are allied with the king of the south. The king of the north declares war on Iran and Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia. They're Iran's allies. And that's a prophesied change to what's happening in the Middle East. Right now, Egypt is not aligned with Iran. In fact, they're historic enemies. When the Shah of Iran fled the Iranian Revolution, he went to Egypt. And then Iran was behind terrorists who killed Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. And those two cut off diplomatic relations for years. And Iran was very blatant about their support for Sadat's assassination. They named a street after the guy that killed Sadat. It would be kind of like Russia naming a street Lee Harvey Oswald Street in Moscow. Very provocative. And that is starting to thaw. You're getting more contact between Iran and Egypt, and you're having the Iran just recently. We covered this on one of our Friday Week in Review shows. The Egyptian president, the Iranian president talking, Egyptian foreign minister, Iranian foreign minister visiting each other. And you see Iran's defeat in Syria and Lebanon. They still want to get at Jerusalem. They still have that focus. And so now watch for them to work much more closely with Egypt. And Egypt has their own terrorist group, the Muslim Brotherhood, a terrorist group. They're older than Iran. They're another major root of Islamist terrorism. They go back to really the 1920s, and they kind of pioneered this three-pronged strategy for terrorism where you have a military wing, you have a government or politics wing, and you have a charity wing that all kind of work together. And the charity aspect genuinely does some good things to help people in dire financial need, But the goal of that is to recruit people to your cause so that they can help your political movement and so that then they can supply new recruits for your terrorism and your military wing. And then the military wing and the political wing work together to topple the state. And they did take over for a few years in Egypt. But that's a group there that Iran does work with and can very easily work more closely with. And Israel's peace treaty with Egypt is a core part of its security. It really relies on the fact that it doesn't have an enemy on its southern border. If Iran can change that, they're facing some major setbacks after this war and what has happened already in Lebanon and Syria. It would be a major coup for them. They could change the game again if they can bring Egypt around. And certainly you look at what people in Egypt believe and they're not friendly to Israel. There's this peace treaty, but only 8% of Egyptians, according to one survey, agreed with the proposition people who want to have business or sports contacts with Israelis should be allowed to do so. Only 8%. Most people say no business with Israelis. Only 2% of Egyptians said they agreed with the statement, "I hope that we could be friends with Israelis someday because we're all human beings after all. 94% of Egyptians say they are sincerely worried that Israel wants to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque and our churches and harm our religion. If you bring about democracy in Egypt, they're declaring war on Israel the next day. So that's a powerful potential ally for Iran to work with. And then Libya and Ethiopia are mentioned next. And in the King of the South booklet, Mr. Flory writes, the emphasis in Daniel 11, verse 42 to 43, is on Egypt. Then we have Libya and Ethiopia. This shows that Egypt is the big conquest. It is the real power behind Libya and Ethiopia, which suggests it is going to have a heavy hand in swinging those two nations into the Iranian camp. We need to understand the enormous impact that Egypt working with Iran will have in the Middle East and even globally. This Iran-Egypt axis will change the game in the Middle East, particularly in Libya and Ethiopia. This means we can expect Egypt, with Iran's help, to lead Libya and Ethiopia into the Iranian camp. He quotes Barnes' note saying, a conquest of Egypt was almost in itself a conquest of Libya and Ethiopians, and says, that's exactly right. The real powerhouse here is Egypt. Iran and Egypt will work together to swing Ethiopia and Libya into the Iranian-led King of the South camp, and they're going to do it with a lot of violence. So they're going to bring these powers in there as well. And Libya is a divided mess, in and out of civil war. Ethiopia, and this is a bold prediction, that Ethiopia would swing into the Iranian camp. I've kind of joked before that this is our most controversial forecast, because whenever we write on this, we get a lot of letters, emails from Ethiopia saying it will never happen, it's impossible. Why are you cheering for the terrorists to take over our country? And we're not cheering for it. We're just describing what the Bible says will happen. But Ethiopia is majority Christian, with a strong Muslim minority, around a third. And very recently, they fell apart in a brutal civil war. And you've got tribal divisions, religious divisions. Iran could use that to take over. And you've got a lot of friction between Egypt and Ethiopia anyway, about the River Nile and water use along the Nile. And Ethiopia has just finished building a new dam. And Egypt's concerned that Libya's taking more water, and that has massive impacts on Egypt's fragile economy. And Ethiopia says, well, the current treaty is unjust. Why do you get most of the water? Way more than we get per person. That's a potential source for a conflict. Mr. Flory has also written, whoever heavily influences or controls Ethiopia will undoubtedly also control the small areas of Eritrea and Djibouti on the Red Sea coastline. These areas only recently became independent of Ethiopia. Also, I believe the Bible view is that these small areas are included as part of Ethiopia. And Sudan, South Sudan, maybe they'd also be included in this. So Iran is going to shift focus and build up this regional power to the southwest of Israel. And this is a whole region that could turn very quickly. And it's leading to conflict. It's leading to a push. At going back to Daniel 11 and verse 40, it says, at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. There's confrontation between these two, and it's worth looking at this word push. I mean, sometimes In English news, push, it could just be something that's a bit annoying. Yeah, like somebody shoving you, it might be irritating. It's not going to do serious damage. It almost reads a bit like two kids. You know, mom, he's pushing me. But that's not what the Hebrew word for push here means. It's the same word used in Exodus 21 and verse 28, where it talks about an ox goring someone with its horn. Like, this is a very violent word. You know, imagine a great ox or a bull charging someone with its horns. And that could kill someone. That's a dangerous attack. That's not merely an annoyance. And this is Iran having a very deadly strike on Europe. And we see this. They're pushy. They're sponsoring terrorism. They're working on nuclear bombs, nuclear devices. Maybe Israel prevents them from kind of miniaturizing an advanced bomb that they could put on a missile, but they could still work on developing something that they could put in a suitcase and have a suicide bomber carry somewhere. And it could be a multi-pronged attack. This push. In the King of the South booklet, Mr. Flurry writes, "This push no doubt revolves around Jerusalem and biblical Judah, called Israel today, just as the clashes in the time of the Crusades did. That city is the third most holy city in the Islamic world. Pope John Paul II spoke publicly of possibly moving the Roman Catholic Church headquarters there. These two great powerful religions both passionately desire Jerusalem. The most precious jewel of Iran's plan is to conquer Jerusalem. This would galvanize more of the Islamic world behind Iran and spread radical Muslim influence to many countries outside of the Middle East. It could lead to dangerous rioting and terror in Europe, Asia, and even America." So once again, we see this conflict revolves around Jerusalem. And we can look at a parallel prophecy in Zechariah chapter 14 that tells us more about what will happen in Jerusalem. Zechariah 14 and verse 1 says, "Behold, the day of the eternal comes, and your spoil shall be divided in the midst of you. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to do battle, and the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall not be cut off from the city." And verse 2 is in reverse chronological order, telling us how this great battle at Christ's return, that's what this passage is all about, how this great battle comes about. You know, verse 3 says, "Then shall the Eternal go forth and fight against those nations as when he fought in the day of battle." So what verse 2 starts with, all nations being gathered against Jerusalem to battle, that's kind of step 3. That's what this is leading to. "Then shall the city be taken." This is the second event. And then the first event is, "And half of the city shall go forth into captivity." So first, half of Jerusalem is conquered. And Mr. Flurry wrote in an article, "Jerusalem is about to be cut in half. The fall of half of Jerusalem triggers a violent and massive chain reaction that leads to Christ's second coming." The same article states, "This first phase could happen at any time. The Palestinians, backed by Iran, will almost certainly do this violent deed. They'll come and conquer half of Jerusalem, presumably East Jerusalem, and it will start this chain reaction." In his book, The Eternal Has Chosen Jerusalem, Mr. Flurry writes, "This push by the King of the South will probably be directly related to Jerusalem. It could well be that the Arabs, incited by Iran, conquering half the city. The Palestinians could, and I believe will, conquer the Temple Mount and refuse access to anybody else. This would rapidly unite Europe and the Israeli Jews against them." So Iran, or Palestinian terrorists backed by Iran, taking half of Jerusalem, that will very likely be the push. We see Iran generally has a pushy foreign policy. They're doing this all the time. And this fall of half of Jerusalem, that's likely going to be a major part of that push. There are other aspects of this. You could see Iran doing other things at the same time that half of Jerusalem falls. Mr. Flurry points out in Daniel 11 that the mention of Libya, Ethiopia, and Egypt tells us a lot about Iran's strategy. In particular, Libya and Ethiopia, he says, "These two nations are the key that unlocks the strategy of radical Islam. That strategy is going to shake the US and Europe to their foundations. Why would Iran be so interested in gaining control over Libya and Ethiopia? To me, the answer is intriguing. Get a good map of the Middle East, particularly on the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea. You can quickly see why the King of the South or radical Islam is so interested in an alliance with or control over these two countries, as well as Egypt and Tunisia, even, he mentions. They are on the two seas that comprise the most important trade route in the world. Whoever influences or controls..." Well, it goes on to talk about if you control Ethiopia, you can have a lot of influence and control over the whole Red Sea coastline. in particular Eritrea and Djibouti. If you control Egypt, you're going to control the Suez Canal. But he says, well, controlling the Suez Canal isn't enough. Egypt tried that in 1976, where Britain, France, and Israel kicked it out in one attack. But the situation's altogether different if the sea trade route is lined with radical Islamic nations possessing real air power, including missiles and drones. This could give Iran virtual control of the trade through these seas. Radical Islam could stop the flow of essential oil to the US and Europe. Iran could also use these trade routes to get control of Jerusalem, Islam's third holiest site. I believe Jerusalem is more important than oil is. And Mr. Flyer wrote about this years ago. We see Iran working on this strategy already, the way they're working with the Houthis in Yemen and using that to take pot shots at shipping through the Red Sea and prompting a lot of shipping to go all the way around Africa. Well, then what if they step that up? They get Egypt, they get Libya. They're now on the Mediterranean Sea. They can go after shipping that Europe has just taken for granted is safe and secure. I mean, what starts to happen if you start having Houthi-style attacks, but coming from Libya? And they're hitting all the masses of trade that's coming through the Red Sea for the Mediterranean Sea. And it's not just oil going on ships through the Red Sea, but it's the pipelines for oil and natural gas that connect North Africa to Europe. They're under attack. You can see that being a violent push at Europe. And you can see how so much of this prophecy is already in the process of being fulfilled. If we go back to Daniel 11 and verse 40, it says that the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overthrow and pass over. Like a whirlwind, Gesenius' lexicon says that means to sweep away in a storm. It's also defined as to bristle with terror. It's a terrifying, shocking attack. In the King of the South, Mr. Flurry writes, it can also mean terror-stricken or shivering with fear, invoking the creeping of the skin of one who is terrorized. This word is an unusual emphasis on terror. Will this terrifying whirlwind be nuclear? It certainly will be terrorizing. It's about to explode in the Middle East. Finally, the terrorists themselves will be terrorized. We've talked about how the King of the North is this beast power. In Revelation 13 and verse 4, the nations of the world are recorded saying, well, who is likened to the beast? Who can make war with him? The whole world is terrified by the strength of this attack. This is how Iran is going to fall. Israel isn't going to permanently and completely defeat Iran with what they're doing in the Middle East with this war. Now, maybe they'll have some success. Who knows how much success? Maybe they will even be able to take out the Ayatollah. But as we've seen, getting rid of a government and is one thing, but it's a whole lot harder to try and set up a stable alternative government in a country. You have to fundamentally turn the nation's course around. So this may be a setback for Iran, but the King of the South is going to be dealt with by this terrifying European attack. Israel isn't going to solve the problem. But you can see how this attack could even prepare the way for this much bigger, more terrifying attack. You know, this king of the north will look and see that what Israel did, their aerial bombardments and their covert drone operations, as impressive as it is, as bold as it is, as successful as it was in many ways, they'll see that it wasn't enough to completely destroy Iran. And they'll be like, well, you know, we need to go in a whole lot stronger. And they'll launch a terrifying attack that maybe even uses nuclear weapons. And that's how they deal with them. They also, this word whirlwind unlocks another aspect of the strategy of the King of the North. A whirlwind, you know, whirls around. There's an emphasis also on kind of surrounding, attacking from all sides. Mr. Flurry writes, if you're in a whirlwind, it whirls around you. Even now, we can see the German strategy is to surround Iran and its allies. Sanxino says the King of the North will swoop down. This isn't simply a straight-on attack, it's a storm that whirls around and around, invading the land and flooding it. That fits perfectly with Iran's geography. Iran is very mountainous on its border with Iraq, but throughout the Middle East, it's got a lot of areas that aren't as protected. If you can attack from a lot of different directions, also if you can come at Iran from the east, from the other side of Iran, the border there is much easier to come through. This is how they tend to have been successfully invaded in the past. If you're not Alexander the Great, you know, the Mongols conquered them from that side. It's much easier there. So Germany is working to surround Iran and to surround Iran's allies and proxies and come at them on all sides. That includes what's going on in North Africa and the way that Iran spreads into North Africa and Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia. The chairman of the German Federal Armed Forces Association, Lieutenant Colonel André Wünster, he talked about terrorist attacks in Mali about 10 years ago. He said it makes it clear once again that a ring of fire extends from Africa via Yemen, Syria, and Iraq to Africa. And he talked about Germany's need to confront Iran throughout this ring of fire. That's this whirlwind strategy surrounding radical Islam. They're working on the same strategy prophesied in the Bible. And then there's a separate prophecy in Psalm chapter 83 that talks about all these allies of the King of the North. And again, we've made a video on that. We can put that in the show notes if you want more information about that alliance. So they come with this great, ferocious force. And then verse 41 says, "He shall enter into the glorious land." And this Hebrew word for enter, it indicates a peaceful entry, not invade the glorious land, not conquer the glorious land. But you know, they just walk in. The indication there is they're welcomed in as peacekeepers, maybe even liberators. And this ties in with a host of other prophecies talking about the Jews in the Middle East and the rest of the nations of Israel, just trusting this European power, seeing them as saviors and deliverers, welcoming them with open arms. And then after that, it says, "But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him, and therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly make away many." And in Ezekiel, the end time prophet, Mr. Flurry wrote, "The King of the North, the Holy Roman Empire, will hear troubling news from the east and the north. These tidings come after the King of the South has been destroyed. They come from the Asian axis. There's a group of Asian powers allying together. And they're talked about again in Revelation as well, the way of the kings of the east. It says the Holy Roman Empire will be disturbed about what the Russians and Chinese are doing. Before this, when the tribulation begins, this emperor will be cooperating with the Russians and Chinese to besiege the Anglo-Saxon nations economically. But perhaps he hears rumors that the Asian Axis is planning to invade North America and conquer it for its own. Regardless of what the exact tidings are, the Bible is clear it will be the Holy Roman Empire that single-handedly invades North America. This passage is clear that these tidings will provoke the emperor to go forth with great fury and to destroy." And this begins this great time of trouble that then Daniel chapter 12 and verse 1 talks about. "And at that time shall Michael stand, the great prince that stands for the children of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time." So that is how Iran is ultimately going to fall. It's not going to be destroyed by Israel. They're going to survive. Maybe it will be like Iraq after the first Gulf War, where they were taken down many pegs, but Saddam Hussein survived and remained a danger. Again, possible to have regime change, but the replacement regime has a similar ideology. It's much easier to get rid of people you don't like than to create a stable replacement government. And in some ways, well, that overview could seem like bad news. This evil regime that spreads a lot of evil across the Middle East and does a lot of harm to its own people and is building nuclear weapons, they're not going to be destroyed by Israel right now. And in fact, they're going to go on to help launch and back a brutal attack on East Jerusalem and launch a violent, deadly push against Europe. And then that's going to escalate and build into a horrific nuclear World War III. You look at it that way and it can seem like a discouraging message. But there is tremendous hope here. I'm going to turn over to Psalm chapter 9. You look in the Psalms a lot. And David prayed to God about dealing with the wicked. And as we see Israel dealing with Iran, you know, dealing with this problem, taking out an evil regime, but knowing, well, they're not going to take it out completely. This evil regime is going to hang around. It's going to continue. I've been thinking a lot about some of David's prayers for God to deal with adversaries, deal with evil people, deal with people that are causing a lot of suffering. God is going to punish Iran. God is going to bring about freedom for Iran and for the whole world. Daniel 9 and verse 5 says, "You have rebuked the heathen. You have destroyed the wicked. You have put out their name forever and ever. O you enemy, destructions are come to a perpetual end. You have destroyed cities, their memorial has perished with them. But the Eternal shall endure forever. He has prepared his throne for judgment. And he shall judge the world in righteousness. He shall minister judgment to the people in uprightness. David looked forward to the time when the wicked would be destroyed and God would judge the world in righteous judgment. And in doing so, bring peace and prosperity and security to the whole world. And I think when you see Iranian missiles raining down on Tel Aviv and what they're doing, what they're prophesied to do, we can want Israel to just come along and destroy the wicked right now. But a loving God has a plan, and he is controlling how this all works out as part of that wonderful plan. In his book, The Psalter of Tara, Mr. Flowery writes, "These are promises we can cling to. The wicked will be brought to justice. Oppression will cease. This is a wonderful prophecy we all need to have our minds on daily. Christ tells us to regularly pray, 'Thy kingdom come.' That is a prayer for God's retribution, destroying the kingdoms of the world and replacing them with the kingdom of God. That is zeal for God's righteousness and for the victory of his kingdom." And he points to the end of this chapter, verse 18, "For the needy shall not always be forgotten. The expectation of the poor shall not perish forever. Arise, O Eternal, let not man prevail. Let the heathen be judged in your sight. Put them in fear, O Eternal, that the nations may know themselves to be but men." Selah. What an invaluable lesson human beings must learn, right, Mr. Flowery? They need to be put in fear and to know they're just men. That is a wonderful thing to pray. So God is going to intervene, but in his time and in a way that helps the whole world. And he's allowing this, you know, he's allowing the evil regime in Iran to continue and persist to help all nations, to help us in Britain, in America, Israel, around the world, realize our sins. Realize the things that we are doing that are causing suffering, the evil that we're spreading around the world, the moral evil, the corruption, the immorality that's coming out of our nations that are causing a lot of suffering. God is using these powers to correct that. And then he'll correct those powers because he loves the people of Iran and he loves those that live in Europe and in Asia. And he's going to bring everybody to repentance so that they can live the way of life that causes blessings and good things and happiness, the way of life described by his law. And this clash revolves around Jerusalem, the city from which God will rule and bring peace to the whole world. And this is Satan's world right now. Satan's the god of this world, the Bible says. And he has a hatred for Jerusalem and what God will do with that city. And so this clash revolves around Jerusalem, but God is more powerful than Satan. He's allowing, even though it's Satan's world, he's allowing these world events to happen according to his plan. And there's going to be a deliverance and a wonderful way of life and teaching flowing out from Jerusalem. In Prophesy Again, Mr. Flowery writes, "I suspect there's another big reason why that clash is over Jerusalem. Satan knows our immediate future will be in that city. That is where Christ and his true church will be serving at headquarters. That is where God the Father will bring down New Jerusalem to this earth. Satan knows about that dazzling future, and it enrages him. Matthew 24 and verse 2 tells us there won't be one brick left upon another. The beast power doesn't want Jerusalem or Islam around. That church-state combine doesn't want any competition. After all, Jerusalem belongs to them, they reason. That is coming right out of the mind of the devil. He wants to stop God's plan and his rule of the universe from Jerusalem." Mr. Flowery has said, "God's mind is continually set on New Jerusalem. His entire plan is built around New Jerusalem." So this clash does point us to a city that is all about God the Father dwelling with mankind. How God brings about this new world full of peace and joy. And even right in the middle of Daniel chapter 11, it talks about his first fruits, his church that he's working with and training to serve the world as part of his government, to be teachers, to warn the world now, to help bring the world to repentance as they see these events unfold, and teach the world. So there is wonderful hope behind these events in Daniel chapter 11. So hopefully I've taken you through in more detail than we usually have time for how Daniel chapter 11 is the key to understanding what's happening in the Middle East, what is next for Iran, why Iran is the King of the South. And if you would like to get into this in more detail, we do have our free book, The King of the South, that's just, I think explains everything so clearly from first principles. It's such a great introduction even to all of Bible prophecy. The final chapter is emphasis on God's very elect. That gets into what I was just touching on at the end there, where you can get more information about how God's people are right in the midst of this. There's a chapter on Psalm 83 that I talked about. There's a chapter on Obama and the King of the South. That's something we didn't really get into, but the way that the Obama administration really strengthened Iran and helped pave the way for them to be this King of the South power. So there's so much in that. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to send you a free print copy. There's no shipping costs. There's no handling costs. You know, it says add it to the basket on the website, but it's all free. We just need your name and address so we can send it to you. Then there's no follow-up. We're not going to call you and badger you for donations or to come to church services with us or anything like that. We'll just send it to you. We have our free Trumpet print magazine as well that you can get. And again, with that, there's no follow-up. The only follow-up is after 6 months or so, we check that you still want to keep receiving that magazine. We don't want to be wasting your time and ours if you don't want it. But that's it. Now, if you do then want to attend services with us, want more information, that's on you. You need to contact us. We don't want to chase you for that. God is calling people out to be part of his church. It's not for us to try and persuade people to join. So we're not going to be coming after you, though. We're not going to be selling your data or anything like that. We just want to share this wonderful, hope-filled truth with you. So if you go to our website or if you look in the show notes, we'll have a link to that booklet. Thank you very much to joining us. If you have any questions, any comments, want to learn more, you can drop us an email, trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com, or you can leave us a comment on YouTube or on Rumble. Thank you very much to George Haddad for engineering and production. We'll be back with our Week in Review show on Friday. Until then, keep watching your world.